This is the BBC.
Hello, thank you for listening to this edition of Inside Health. I hope you enjoy it. Coming up today, carpal tunnel syndrome, hernias and varicose veins, and why you might now struggle to get any of them treated on the NHS. And the difficulty's not limited to these common complaints. Clinical commissioning groups in the Midlands have been in the headlines this week after raising the bar for eligibility for hip and knee replacements. If you live in Worcestershire, your arthritis now needs to be severe enough to cause pain that interferes with daily life and keeps you awake at night. If it's not, then the local CCGs won't pay for the surgery, a move they believe will lead to 350 fewer operations, saving them around £20 million a year to spend on other therapies they deem higher priority. Prioritisation is otherwise known as rationing, and there's a burgeoning number of interventions on the not normally funded list produced by CCGs to show what they're not prepared to pay for, unless there are exceptional circumstances. Clinicians with patients they regard as special cases with things like hernias have to seek approval using an individual funding request, or IFR, which is appraised by a panel to check the patient meets the necessary criteria. Jonathan Earnshaw is a consultant surgeon at Cheltenham General Hospital.
Groin hernias are very common, and the danger with having a groin hernia is strangulation, where a piece of bowel gets into the hernia and twists. And in that circumstance, people need an urgent hernia repair, and sometimes even the bowel needs to be removed. And the reason for doing routine elective hernia repair is to prevent strangulation. The problem is it's really very tricky to assess whether an individual hernia is likely to strangulate. And for that reason, we've ended up in the past operating on most people who have hernias, unless there was a strong reason not to, if someone was very elderly or unfit. And very occasionally, I suppose, we wouldn't treat minor, small hernias. But essentially, all people with hernias had surgery for them.
So fast forward to today, what's the situation now?
Well, over the last 10 years, we've certainly had various different protocols that have been given to us to try and reduce the number of hernias that we operate on. Sometimes we've been asked to mend just painful ones, or sometimes we've been asked to mend only ones that are likely to strangulate. But that's a very non-specific way of being able to tell the difference between hernias. And that's not very helpful for me to decide whether or not to fix them.
And the driver behind that has been what? The clinical evidence base that shows that some hernias don't need treating, won't cause trouble, or is it mainly a cost issue?
The main driver, as with all, so many of these things, is cost, to reduce the number of hernias that are done that really are never going to strangulate. The science shows, actually, that if you take people with small hernias, and there have been a couple of randomised trials where people either operate on a hernia or select patients for watchful waiting and see what happens over a number of years. If you do that over about 10 years, most in the watchful waiting group get bigger and need surgery.
So you might be delaying the inevitable with a lot of these patients.
I think that's exactly what you do.
But what's practically involved as a consultant? So I see somebody with a common type of hernia. I send them to you. You then look at them and say, I think, you know, this needs an operation. What happens?
So at the moment, rules have changed. A couple of years ago, we all had to fill a form in, which was sent to the interventions not normally funded group, and they checked the forms to see whether they match criteria for surgery.
So this was even though you decided that the patient needed surgery, somebody else is checking that decision.
Was checking it, yes, and turning some of them down, saying that they weren't suitable for repair, particularly those who had direct, more mild hernias. If my clinic letter didn't say that they had severe pain, then they were often turned down.
So severe pain being one of the boxes you had to tick.
Being one of the boxes, absolutely. And in a working age person, having a hernia, particularly if you've got a manual job, can be very uncomfortable.
So are you spending a lot of your time now filling in these funding referrals for hernias?
No, that seems to have stopped. And I've assumed that the clinical commissioning groups have found that it actually doesn't reduce the number of people who get operations, and therefore that the costs of this layer of bureaucracy actually aren't worth it.
So essentially, it might have been that it was an administrative hurdle that wasn't actually making a lot of difference.
Exactly right.
How does your practice here compare to practices elsewhere in the country? Are you operating on a similar proportion of the hernias that you see?
No. My colleagues around the country tell me that there's a very big discrepancy between who gets hernia repairs. In some places like Gloucestershire, it's pretty easy to get your hernia repaired if there is an appropriate reason for doing so.
So that's your decision?
So that's my decision. What happens for that is that because people are able to travel, as they often come over here to get their hernia repaired from neighbouring counties. In many parts of the country, it's extraordinarily difficult to get your hernia repaired. And the difficulty, of course, is to assess which hernias are the ones which are most likely to strangulate. It's a very difficult clinical decision.
But it must be that your colleagues in other parts of the country are wanting to operate on the ones that they think might strangulate. So are they better or worse at selecting them than you, or is it an inexact science?
It's a very inexact science, and I think it must be deeply frustrating to find that you can only operate on a very small proportion of people with hernias, because hernias are uncomfortable, and it's one of the operations I do that people seem to derive most benefit from in terms of improving their symptoms.
And if you're not operating on many people, you will, by default, miss some that go on to strangulate.
Yes, and I would imagine that in areas where you don't do a lot of elective hernia repairs, you will start to see people with strangulated hernias. And fixing a strangulated hernia in emergency is not an easy thing to do.
Surgeon Jonathan Earnshaw. Inside Health's Margaret McCartney's been looking at what research says about the impact of limiting access to treatments like hernia surgery.
Mark, I have found the evidence. It's taken me the best part of a week, but I can back this up. In 2009, the Department of Health had asked the management consultancy McKinsey to find out how to make services more cost-effective in England. And one of the things they proposed was that groin hernias, in the main, didn't have to be operated on, because mainly people got on just as well if they didn't have an operation than if they did. And this was proposed as a cost-saving device, and as a result, many CCGs decided to no longer operate routinely for people who had groin hernias that didn't seem to be causing them much problem. And that might seem on one level absolutely fine. Why interfere with something that wasn't causing you problems anyway? But at that time, no one had investigated what the consequences of this new policy would be. Well, a group of surgeons went and looked to see what happened in the 16 months before and after this new policy. And what they found was that this policy change made more people who had a hernia that hadn't been operated on end up turning up as an emergency, needing an emergency procedure done on that hernia that had then developed a problem.
And in terms of numbers, what sort of numbers are we talking about?
Overall, it's still small. So this is not to needlessly alarm people who decided on the basis of a discussion with their doctor or healthcare provider not to have surgery. But what these doctors found, that there was a pretty much a doubling of people needing emergency repaired who hadn't had the operation done. That was 3.6% versus 5.5%. And what was really important was the people in that group who did need emergency care tended to have more adverse effects, more problems after the surgery compared with people who'd had it done routinely. That's the big problem.
Knowing how cynical our Inside Health audience is, I suppose my next question should be, well, surgeons would say that, wouldn't they?
Mark, I like the cynicism. I support cynicism myself. But this was just number counting. This was just looking at what happened afterwards. So I think in this study, there was a limited chance of bias.
So we're looking at something like just under 1 in 20 people needing to have emergency surgery if they were left.
Yeah. Now, we can't prove cause and effect. This wasn't a randomised controlled trial. It was a study looking at the association of a new policy. But it's the best data we have, and that is flagging up a problem. Now, it's completely different if people are sitting down talking about what to do about a problem and making a valid decision based on individual judgment about a set of circumstances. The big problem is that McKinsey, who made the recommendation not to routinely operate on people with inguinal hernias, they based this policy on trials that were done from America. But the trials are flawed when we start compare them with practice in the UK of enforcing this policy, because over half the people offered entry into the trials didn't take part in it. They declined to do so. They wanted to have surgery anyway. So we cannot compare like with like. We cannot say that, therefore, this policy is going to benefit our patients in the UK. The data was flawed.
So the findings of the research might have been skewed by the people who were included in the trial, but you're confident that this second trial, where the surgeons went to look to see what happened to these people, that was reflective of real life practice?
Well, this is real life practice. It's not a clinical trial. We can't prove cause and effect, but we certainly can say that this policy was associated with a change in the amount of people who presented as an emergency.
Margaret McCartney. Hand surgery is another area that's been targeted by CCGs looking to save resources. Ash Merry's specialist, had to apply for funding when he felt she needed surgery for carpal tunnel syndrome, a common complaint caused by entrapment of one of the nerves supplying the hand, and it was giving her a lot of trouble.
Pins and needles, not during the day, but specifically at night. And I used to lie in bed, put my hands above my head, and I was kept awake literally by the pain in my right hand. And it is excruciating. It's like electric shocks going up and down your arm, and you cannot stop it. It was quite literally wrecking my life, I felt.
And how long had that been going on before you first sought medical advice?
Not sleeping at night, it has been going on intermittently, probably for about a year.
So you went to see a doctor?
Yes. I went to see the doctor in March 2016, and I went to see a consultant before Christmas, and I thought, oh, this is to check, yes, what surgery is going to be. No, it wasn't. We have to now apply for funding.
Had you ever heard of anything like this happening before?
No, I jolly well hadn't.
So I'm Charles Palethorpe. I'm a consultant orthopaedic surgeon with a specialist interest in the hand at the Royal Berkshire Hospital in Reading. My practice as a hand surgeon has changed quite dramatically over the past couple of years with the individual funding requests policy. It's become almost an administrative nightmare, having to spend more and more time filling in forms. I don't think it's got any benefit to my patients at all. And the problem in hand surgery is that it affects almost half my practice. So simple, in relative terms, conditions called carpal tunnel syndrome, which is a trapped nerve, things like a trigger finger where the finger gets caught, and a condition called Dupuytren's where the finger actually gets stuck. These are common hand conditions, but now have to have funding requested. CCGs have stated in their funding request information that exceptional health requirements is over and above what is there for the general public. But if you've got a condition that's affecting your life and stopping you either from sleeping, like carpal tunnel syndrome, or you're unable to do your job because you can't feel your hands and you're dropping things, why is that exceptional above the general public? It's not. And so this rationing purposes doesn't take into effect what's happening to the actual patient themselves. And so from my perspective, my job is to treat the patient. And each patient who uses their hands is individual. We're all individuals, we all use our hands, we all abuse our hands, but we all do it differently. So what is a problem for one person isn't for somebody else. And so actually, having a checklist of so-called interventions before you can do surgery doesn't make sense for an individual, where there may well be exceptional reasons. So I'm having my professional integrity, in essence, questioned by having to prove exceptional health requirements.
Is that part of it, though? I mean, that you feel that you're being undermined professionally? I mean, is that one of the reasons that, I mean, it gets your goat? I can feel it.
You know, I've been a hand surgeon here since 1995. I think I'm not a knife-happy surgeon. I'm a very cautious surgeon. But when I do make a decision with the patient's agreement that surgery is appropriate, I'd like to feel that I have the professional integrity that that's correct.
Looking at carpal tunnel syndrome, it's a common problem. We see a lot of it in general practice, refer a lot of it to surgeons like you. How many of the patients that you feel definitely need an operation do you get approved easily, or are you constantly getting refusals?
We think that we're probably getting about a 20% rejection rate, and that's largely based on a failure of the checklist concept. So if they haven't had a splint or if they haven't had an injection, it's often rejected and say, why haven't they had an injection? Despite the fact that I've put down sometimes the reason why I think an injection's not appropriate, because there are sometimes reasons, they've still been rejected.
Because that's the other part of the rationalisation, isn't it? It's not just about saving resources, but it's using resources appropriately and getting people to follow guidelines. So, for instance, with carpal tunnel, they might get somebody like me to say, we'll try a splint for 4 to 6 weeks first, then refer to you, who you might consider an injection, for, and then surgery as a last resort.
And I don't have a problem with that, actually. But there are exceptions. What we haven't got at the moment is a way of agreeing those exceptions with the clinical groups. For example, in carpal tunnel syndrome, if somebody's got wasting of their thumb muscles, that should be just let through. You know, we shouldn't have to
apply
for
it. They need an operation.
Yeah, they need an operation. It's a barn door decision. You just need to get on and get it done, sort of thing.
I have paid contributions for 37 years. I can understand that good housekeeping is vital. However, when it comes to something like carpal tunnel surgery, as I understand it, when it is severe, whatever you do to it, at some stage surgery is going to be needed to stop progression of impairment in your dominant hand. I would argue that any delay could be more costly to the NHS.
So what happened in your case?
Well, what happened in my case is, I have to say, I made a bit of a noise. I was constantly chasing it. So when funding was approved, the process was really remarkably quick. I since found out there are vacant surgery slots that are not being filled with staff on standby, which is costing money, that are going vacant because they were waiting for funding requests to be approved.
To me, it's almost as if some days they've used their quota up, because it seems to be completely irrational. Other ones go through without a problem, and then I'll get one rejected.
What happens to those 20% of patients? What's the risk of not operating on somebody like Ash?
Well, the risk in her case, in fact, is that the pressure on the nerve caused permanent damage.
So looking at those 20% that are refused, are any of them ever going to get better on their own, or are they going to end up under your care having an operation at some stage?
I don't think it ever goes. The trouble is that the literature is confusing sometimes when it comes to certain treatments, particularly when it comes to simple things like carpal tunnel, because sometimes there isn't an awful lot of evidence, but there's an awful lot of common sense and experience.
Because this is one of the areas that the people behind these criteria say, look, there isn't enough evidence to support this intervention. And what you're saying is, just because there isn't enough evidence, it might be that the trials haven't been done. It's not that the procedure doesn't work. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, to a certain extent, yes. Though there is, I think, more evidence coming out. There is a big study, in fact, in Sweden on corticosteroid injections, and showed that, again, in certain specific instances, is actually a very effective treatment and will reduce the symptoms for a year or more.
But is it delaying the inevitable?
They eventually all still come to surgery at some point, because nobody has followed them up for another 10 years. And so that's why the evidence is fundamentally flawed. And I do have some patients who grumble along for years, and some ladies who've come to me in their sort of 50s, 60s and said, well, I've had it for 20 years, but now actually I can't feel my fingers. Well, it's almost too late then. So there comes a time where actually there is an opportune time to get on with it.
What's happening in other parts of the country? Is this something that's happening pretty uniformly?
No, I don't think so. It seems to me that there are some of my colleagues I've chatted to, they said, what are IFRs? Individual funding requests. They don't have to do them. So some parts of the country, it's not active at the moment. But other parts, it's obviously almost draconian.
Ash mentioned empty slots where, because the funding's not coming through, there's a slot that could have been used, but the team's all still there. Is that actually happening?
Yes. We were planning to do a list at the end of January, and we have something, I think, in the region of 40 to 50 patients where we're waiting on funding. So it was all set to go, but we just haven't got the patients at the moment to fill the list. Overall, there's a lot of waste of money in this process. We've had to employ an administrative staff just for IFRs.
Charles Palethorpe and his patient Ash Merry. Back in Cheltenham, surgeon Jonathan Earnshaw treats varicose veins as well as hernias, and he too has witnessed a dramatic change in practice over recent years. His team now does half the operations it used to.
Over the years, there's been an increasing thought that, in fact, a lot of varicose veins don't need to be done. They're either cosmetic or there's no medical advantage in doing them. And so we've had great restrictions on the sort of veins that we can treat. So we tend now only to be allowed to treat people who've got complications from their veins, not just simple discomfort.
And the sort of complications that you'd have to have, the boxes that you'd have to tick to get approved for your surgery, would be what?
So if you have varicose veins long enough, they start to affect the skin around your ankle, and you've seen the brown speckling there, which is called varicose eczema, and that's a sign that there's high pressure in the veins of the skin. If you don't treat people with varicose eczema, there's a high chance if they damage their skin, they will get a varicose ulcer. And varicose ulcers are common, particularly in the elderly. So the idea of treating people with varicose veins is to prevent them getting the complications of varicose ulcer.
And presumably, once somebody develops that complication, that's expensive and difficult to deal with.
Oh, yes, and painful. And it's horrible having a varicose ulcer. It really grossly affects quality of life. And most of the guidelines and restrictions on treatment for varicose veins allow treatment of people with complicated varicose veins for that very reason. And the guidelines for varicose veins are much easier because the classification of varicose veins is easier. It's obvious when people are starting to get complications from their veins, and those are the ones we treat. It's obvious which are the ones don't have complications, and those, generally speaking, are the ones that we don't treat.
Are you happy with where the bar is set?
Well, again, the bar is very variable around the country. Here in Gloucestershire, we're allowed to treat people with complicated varicose veins and people whose varicose veins severely affect their quality of life. The problem, of course, is who decides whether a quality of life is severely affected? And we often end up having quite uncomfortable consultations in outpatients where perhaps my perception of quality of life isn't quite the same as the person who has their varicose veins. And that can lead to considerable difficulty.
So will you sometimes tell a patient in outpatients, look, you're not going to meet the threshold, we're not going to be able to operate on you, or we don't need to operate on you?
That happens in every clinic that I do. We have people who come with what they regard as severe symptoms from their varicose veins, but actually, when you question them, they're not affecting their sleep, they don't require painkillers, they're not actually affecting their work, and under those circumstances, our local commissioning wouldn't fund that intervention. So I have to tell patients then that I can't operate on their veins.
But what happens to them if you don't operate on their veins? I mean, they're not going to get better, are they? I mean, presumably with time they get worse. Are we just delaying the inevitable here as well?
Well, that's not quite the case, because as a GP, you will have had many patients who have had varicose veins for years and years and years and years and years that never ever get any complications. And if we could predict which people with varicose veins were going to go on and get complications, then it would be easy to select those out. But we can't. And most people don't get complications in their varicose veins. So there are reasonable medical reasons for not operating, not treating people with varicose veins until they actually start to get the complications.
So what might happen is a patient might be referred into you. You say, don't need to operate or can't operate now. Come back when you've got a complication. For those that do.
Exactly right. And as a surgeon who's been in one place for a very long time, that happens not infrequently. But of course, the corollary of that is that I've sent away a lot of people and reassured them their veins are no threat to their health, and they've never come back over the years.
Jonathan Earnshaw. Clinical commissioning groups, CCGs, are in a difficult position, squeezed between the expectations of their public and the demands of their doctors and other healthcare professionals. Buckinghamshire GP Graham Jackson is chair of his local CCG and co-chair of NHS Clinical Commissioners.
Clinical commissioning groups are allocated a certain amount of resource from central government to spend on healthcare in their locality or their area. And what we have to do is decide how to spend that resource most effectively. Cancer services, emergency services, surgical interventions. And so we have to make decisions based on the population, and remembering the populations differ from different parts of the country. And then how we spend that money is based on their local need.
And put simply, if you spend more money on people having minor varicose veins treated, for instance, that leaves you less money to help people who might have severe arthritis and require a hip replacement.
Well, it's certainly true. There's only a finite fixed amount of fund.
One of the criticisms aimed at the current setup is that there's something of what's become known as the postcode lottery, that if the criteria for all of these procedures, for getting your hand surgery done, your varicose veins done, or your hip done, was the same in every area of the country, and people understand there are limited resources, then perhaps everyone would buy into it much more. Why is there this variability?
I think the variability comes back to the fact that we are locally focused. And so the priorities for spending healthcare in a particular area need to be matched to the priorities of that population. And it's really important to understand that the local population has different needs from different parts of the country, even actually in, say, the same county in different areas based on their age, profile, etc.
And are some CCGs under more financial pressures than others because of that changing in demography?
I think that is true. There is an allocation across the country from CCG to CCG based on that profile, but it's very difficult to make those allocations absolutely accurate everywhere.
One of the concerns, I suppose, is that we are delaying the inevitable, so that by reducing perhaps the number of hernias that we operate on, we end up maybe with more people coming in with strangulations that are expensive and obviously have implications for the patient. I mean, presume we're monitoring this situation ongoing to check that these interventions are cost-effective in the long term.
Yes, there's a lot of monitoring going on, a number of interventions. But I think it comes back to the whole picture again. We have an ageing population with an increasing number of illnesses that need to be dealt with.
Do you know for sure that your gateways, if you like, to limit the treatments that are being done, to prioritise the treatments that you'll be done, actually work in terms of cost effectiveness, that they're saving your CCG money?
I think there is monitoring within the system, and clearly there's a cost for those gateways, and we have to be honest, there is a cost to run those gateways, and it's important those costs are monitored against the cost of procedures.
Because it might be that a particular gateway that's put in, with all the best intentions, might end up not working. It might not be cost effective to do that, but to make that decision, you need to be monitoring these very closely, and that is going on, is it, across the country?
It is going on, and then there is clearly... Everything we do has a cost attached to it, and it's the basic premise is that we have limited resource and we must not squander that resource.
Yes, I mean, we mustn't squander it on unnecessary treatments, but we mustn't squander it on unnecessary admin. But we're Absolutely. Looking at the treatments from an evidence base. I mean, I'm just asking, are we applying those same stringent rules to the gateway interventions, to the admin behind this?
The gateway interventions are monitored monetarily, but also from a quality perspective to make sure they do provide the quality assessment that we need.
Dr. Graham Jackson. So, given that CCGs across England are monitoring the impact of prioritising treatments like hernia repairs and hand and varicose vein surgery, we went looking for published examples of their findings. When I say we...
Mark, I may never forgive you for this. I've spent the last week trawling through minutes from CCGs looking to see who is looking at the harms of the procedures that people have put in place to try and limit access to interventions. I can find almost none. I can find people that have written down things like, will this affect people, for example, older people more or carers more, qualities analysis, but I cannot find any analysis done of the cost effectiveness of the entire procedure.
Well, Graham says it's being monitored, so one would imagine that if his CCG is doing that that's happening across the country. But what you're saying is that nothing is being published.
I can't find anything in the public domain. If any listeners know of any, please do send it in for me. And of course, there's all sorts of other costs associated with not doing things. For example, people having more physiotherapy, people attending their GP more to get painkillers, people being off work, people maybe needing to see a psychologist, people not being able to care for family or relatives. These costs, I think, are being absorbed elsewhere into the system and are not being properly tabulated.
And, of course, the other aspect is the cost of the bureaucracy itself, which needs to be balanced against the cost of not doing some of these operations.
Yeah, ask GPs how much time they're spending doing paperwork as opposed to face-to-face patient care. It's huge and it's growing, and I don't think anyone's really got a clear handle on how much of this has been generated by CCGs and these type of rules.
But we can't be dismissive of it because we don't know, because the evidence isn't published.
And that's a big problem. Whenever you're putting a new policy into practice, I think it should be incumbent on the policymakers to say, what are the potential harms? What are the potential downsides? And how are we going to find out about them? Because if you don't look for them, you will not find them. They will be buried and they'll just come back to bite you on the posterior later on.
Margaret McCartney, who'll be one of the panellists in our upcoming hour-long special debate on the NHS, What Needs to Give, which will be aired on Valentine's Day. In the meantime, normal service resumes next week when I'll be learning how virtual reality is being used to help people with conditions as diverse as Alzheimer's disease and phantom limb pain, as well as taking a closer look at the latest initiative to limit and target antibiotic use for sore throats. Thank you for listening. For more information on this programme or for other Inside Health programmes, please visit the Radio 4 website.